This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Victoria Long. The History of the Peloponnesian War by Thucydides, translated by Richard Crawley. Book 7, Chapter 21. 18th and 19th Year of the War. Arrival of Gylippus at Syracuse. Fortification of Decelea. Successes of the Syracusans. After refitting their ships, Gylippus and Pison coasted along from Tarentum to Epizephrian Locris. They now received more correct information that Syracuse was not yet completely invested, but that it was still possible for an army arriving at Epipolae to effect an entrance, and they consulted accordingly whether they should keep Sicily on their right and risk sailing in by sea, or leaving it on their left, should they first sail to Himera, and taking with them the Himerians, and any other that might agree to join them, go to Syracuse by land. Finally they determined to sail for Himera, especially as the fourth Athenian ships which Nicias had at length sent off, on hearing that they were at Locris, had not yet arrived at Rhegium. Accordingly, before these reached their post, the Peloponnesians crossed the strait, and, after touching at Rhegium and Messina, came to Himera. Arrived there, they persuaded the Himerans to join in the war, and not only to go with them themselves, but to provide arms for seamen from their vessels with which they had drawn ashore at Himera. And they sent and appointed a place for the Selinuntines to meet with them with all their forces. A few troops were also promised by the Geloans and some of the Sicels, who were now ready to join with them with much greater alacrity, owing to the recent death of Arconidas, a powerful Sicel king in that neighborhood, and friendly to Athens, and owing also to the vigor shown by Gylippus in coming of the Lacedaemonians. Gylippus now took with him about 700 of his sailors and marines, that number only having arms, 1,000 heavy infantry, and light troops from Himera with a body of 100 horse, some light troops and cavalry from Selinus, a few Geloans and Sicels numbering 1,000 in all, and set out on his march for Syracuse. Meanwhile, the Corinthian fleet from Leucas made all haste to arrive, and one of their commanders, Gongylus, started last with a single ship, was the first to reach Syracuse a little before Gylippus. Gongylus found the Syracusans on the point of holding an assembly to consider where they should put an end to the war. This he prevented and reassured them by telling them that more vessels were still to arrive, and that Gylippus, son of Cleandrius, had been dispatched by the Lacedaemonians to take the command. Upon this the Syracusans took courage and immediately marched out with all their forces to meet Gylippus, who they found was now close at hand. Meanwhile, Gylippus, after taking Eate, a fort at Sicels, on his way, formed an army in order of the battle, and so arrived at Epipolae, and ascending by Euryalus, as the Athenians had done at first, now advanced with the Syracusans against the Athenian lines. His arrival chanced at a critical moment. The Athenians had already finished a double wall of 6 or 7 furlongs to the great harbor, with the exception of a small portion next to the sea, with which they were still engaged upon, and in the remainder of the circle towards Troglius on the other sea, stones had been laid ready for the building for the greater part of the distance, and some points had been left half-finished, while others were entirely completed. The danger of Syracuse had indeed been great. Meanwhile, the Athenians, recovering from the confusion into which they had been first thrown by the sudden battle of Gylippus and the Syracusans, formed an order of battle. Gylippus halted at a short distance off, and sent on a herald to tell them that, if they would evacuate Sicily with a bag and baggage within 5 days' time, he was willing to make a truce accordingly. The Athenians treated this proposition with contempt, and dismissed the herald without an answer. After this, both sides began to prepare for action. Gylippus, observing that the Syracusans were in disorder and did not easily fall into line, drew off his troops more into the open ground, while Nicias did not lead the Athenians, but lay still by his own wall. When Gylippus saw that they did not, he led off his army to the citadel of the quarter of Apollo Temenites, and passed the night there. On the following day he led out the main body of his army, and drawing them up in order of battle before the walls of the Athenians to prevent their going to the relief of any other quarter, dispatched a strong force against Fort Labdalum, and took it, and put all whom he found in it to the sword, the place not being within sight of the Athenians. On the same day an Athenian galley that lay moored off the harbor was captured by the Syracusans. After this the Syracusans and their allies began to carry a single wall, starting from the city in a slanted direction up Epipolae, in order that the Athenians, unless they could hinder the work, might be no longer able to invest them. Meanwhile, the Athenians, having now finished their wall down to the sea, had come up to the heights, and part of their wall being weak, Gylippus drew out his army by night and attacked it. However, the Athenians, who happened to be bivouacking outside, took the alarm and came out to meet him, upon seeing which he quickly led his men back again. The Athenians now built their wall higher, and in future kept guard at this point themselves, disposing their confederates along the remainder of the works, as the stations assigned to them. Nicias also determined to fortify Plemmyrium, a promontory over against the city, which juts out and narrows the mouth of the great harbor. He thought that the fortification of this place would make it easier to bring in supplies, as they would be able to carry on their blockade from a less distance near to the port occupied by the Syracusians, instead of being obliged upon every moment of the enemy's navy to put out against them from the bottom of the great harbor. Besides this, he now began to pay more attention to the war by sea, seeing that the coming of Gylippus had diminished their hopes by land. Accordingly, he conveyed over his ships and some troops, and built three forts in which he placed most of his baggage, and moored there for the larger craft and men of war. This was the first and chief occasion of the losses which the crews experienced. The water which they used was scarce and had to be fetched from far, and the sailors could not go out for firewood without being cut off from the Syracusan horse, who were masters of the country. A third of the enemy's cavalry was being stationed at the little town of Olympium to prevent plundering incursions on the part of the Athenians at Plemmyrium. Meanwhile, Nicias learned that the rest of the Corinthian fleet was approaching and sent 20 ships to watch for them, with orders to be on the lookout for them about Locris and Regium and the approach to Sicily. Gylippus, meanwhile, went on with the wall across Epipolae, using the stones which the Athenians had laid down for their own wall, and at the same time constantly led out the Syracusans and their allies, and formed them in order of battle in front of the lines, the Athenians forming against him. At last he thought that the moment was come, and began the attack, and a hand-to-hand fight ensued between the lines, where the Syracusan cavalry could be of no use, and the Syracusans and their allied were defeated and took up their dead under truce, while the Athenians erected a trophy. After this, Gylippus called the soldiers together and said that the fault was not theirs, but his. He had kept their lines too much within the works, and he had thus deprived them of the service of their cavalry and darters. He would now, therefore, lead them on a second time. He begged them to remember that in material force they would be fully a match for their opponents, while with respect to moral advantages it were intolerable if Peloponnesians and Dorians could not feel comfort of incoming Ionians and islanders with the motley rabble that accompanied them, and of driving them out of the country. After this he embraced the first opportunity that offered of again leading them against the enemy. Now Nicias and the Athenians held the opinion that even if the Syracusans should not wish to offer battle, it was necessary for them to prevent the building of the cross wall, as it already almost overlapped the extreme point of their own, and if it went any further, it would from that moment make no difference whether they fought ever so many successful actions or never fought at all. They accordingly came out to meet the Syracusans. Gylippus led out his heavy infantry further from the fortifications than on the former occasion, and so joined battle, posting his horse and darters upon the flank of the Athenians in the open space where the works of the two walls terminated. During the engagement, the cavalry attacked and routed the left wing of the Athenians, which was opposed to them, and the rest of the Athenian army was in consequence defeated by the Syracusans and driven headlong within their lines. The night following, the Syracusans carried the wall up to the Athenian works and passed them, thus putting it out of their power any longer to stop them, and depriving them, even if victorious in the field, of all chance of investing the city for future use. After this, the remaining 12 vessels of the Corinthians, Ambraciots and Leucadians, sailed into the harbor under the command of Erasinides, a Corinthian having eluded the Athenian ships on guard and helping the Syracusans in completing the remainder of the cross wall. Meanwhile, Gylippus went into the rest of Sicily to raise the land and naval forces, and also to bring over any of the cities that either were lukewarm in cause or had hitherto kept out of the war altogether. Syracusan and Corinthian envoys were also dispatched to Lacedaemon and Corinth to get fresh force sent over in any way that might offer, either in merchant vessels or transports, or in any other manner likely to prove successful, as the Athenians were too sending for reinforcements, while the Syracusans proceeded to man a fleet and to exercise, meaning to try their fortune in this way also, and generally became exceedingly confident. Nicias, perceiving this, and seeing the strength of the enemy and his own difficulties daily increasing, himself also sent to Athens. He had before sent frequent reports of events as they occurred, and felt it especially incumbent upon him to do so now, as he thought that they were in a critical position, and that, unless speedily recalled or strongly reinforced from home, they had no hope of safety. He feared, however, that the messengers, either through inability to speak or through failure of memory, or from a wish to please the multitude, might not report to the truth, and so thought it best to write a letter and ensure that the Athenians should know his own opinion without it being lost in transmission, and be able to decide upon the real facts of the case. His emissaries accordingly departed with the letter and the requisite verbal instructions, and he attended to the affairs of the army, making it his aim now to keep on the defensive and to avoid any unnecessary danger. At the close of the same summer, the Athenian general Eutychian marched in concert with Perdiccas with a large body of Thracians against Amphipolis, and failing to take it, brought some galleys round into Strymon and blockaded the town from the river, having his base at Himerium. Summer was now over, the winter ensuing. The persons sent by Nicias, reaching Athens, gave the verbal message that had been entrusted to them, and answered any questions that were asked of them, and delivered the letter. The clerk of the city came forward and read out to the Athenians the letter, which was as follows: "Our past operations, Athenians, have been made known to you by many other letters. It is now time for you to become equally familiar with our present conditions and to take your measures accordingly. We had defeated in most of our engagements with them the Syracusans against whom we were sent, and we built the works which we now occupy, when Gylippus arrived from Lacedaemon with an army obtained from Peloponnese and from some of the cities in Sicily. In our first battle with him we were victorious. In the battle on the following day we were overpowered by a multitude of cavalry and darters, and compelled to retire within our lines. We have now, therefore, been forced by the numbers of those opposed to us to discontinue the work of circumvallation and to remain inactive, being unable to make use even of all the force we have, since a large portion of our heavy infantry is absorbed in the defense of our lines. Meanwhile, the enemy has carried a single wall past our lines, thus making it impossible for us to invest them in future, until this cross wall be attacked by a strong force and captured. So the besieger in name has become, at least from the land side, the besieged in reality, as we are prevented by their cavalry from even going for any distance into the country. Besides this, an embassy has been dispatched to Peloponnese to procure reinforcements, and Gylippus has gone to the cities in Sicily, partly in the hope of inducing those that are at present neutral to join him in the war, partly of bringing from his allies additional contingents for the land forces and materials for the navy. For I understand that they contemplate a combined attack upon our lines with their land forces and with their fleet by sea. You must none of you be surprised that I say by sea also. They have discovered that the length of time we have now been in commission has rotted our ships and wasted our crew, and that with the entireness of our crew and the soundness of our ships, the pristine efficiency of our navy has departed. For it is impossible for us to haul our ships ashore and careen them, because the enemy's vessels being as many or more than our own, we are constantly anticipating an attack. Indeed, they may be seen exercising, and it lies with them to take the initiative, and not having to maintain a blockade, they have greater facilities for drying their ships. This we should scarcely be able to do, even if we had plenty of ships to spare, and we were freed from our present necessity of exhausting all our strength upon the blockade. For it is already difficult to carry in supplies past Syracuse, and we were to relax our vigilance in the slightest degree, it would become impossible. The losses which our crews have suffered and still continue to suffer arise from the following causes. Expeditions for fuel and for forage, and the distance from which water has to be fetched, cause our sailors to be cut off from the Syracusan cavalry. The loss of our previous superiority emboldens our slaves to desert. Our foreign seamen are impressed by the unexpected appearance of a navy against us, and the strength of the navy's resistance, such as them as were pressed into the service, take the first opportunity of departing to their respective cities. Such as were originally seduced by the temptation of high pay, and expecting little fighting and large gains, leave us either the desertion to the army, or by availing themselves of one or other of the various facilities of escape which the magnitude of Sicily affords them. Some even engage in trade themselves, and prevail upon the captains to take Hyccaric slaves on board in their place. Thus they have ruined the efficiency of our navy. Now I need not remind you that the time during which a crew is in its prime is short, and that the number of sailors who can start a ship on her way and keep the rowing in time is small. But by far my greatest trouble is that, holding the post which I do, I am prevented by the natural indocility of the Athenian seamen from putting a stop to these evils, and that meanwhile we have no source from which to recruit our crews, which the enemy can do from many quarters, but are compelled to depend both for supplying the crews in service and for making good our losses upon the men who were brought with us. For our present confederates, Naxos and Catana, are incapable of supplying us. There is only one thing more wanting to our opponents. I mean the defection of our Italian markets. If they were to see you neglect to relieve us from our present condition, and were to go over to the enemy, famine would compel us to evacuate, and Syracuse would finish the war without a blow. I mind, it is true, have written to you something different and more agreeable than this, but nothing certainly more useful, if it is desirable for you to know the real state of things here before taking your measures. Besides, I know that it is in your nature to love to be told the best side of things, and then to blame the teller if the expectations which he has raised in your minds are not answered by the result. And I therefore thought it safest to declare to you the truth. Now you are not to think that either your generals or your soldiers have ceased to be a match for the forces originally opposed to them, but you are to reflect that a general Sicilian coalition is being formed against us, that a fresh army is expected from the Peloponnese, while the force we have here is unable to cope even with our present antagonists, and you must promptly decide either to recall us or to send us to another fleet, an army as numerous again, with a large sum of money and someone to succeed me, as a disease in the kidneys unfits me for retaining my post. I have, I think, some claim on your indulgence, as while I was in my prime I did you much good service in my commands. But whatever you mean to do, do it at the commencement of spring and without delay, as the enemy will obtain his Sicilian reinforcements shortly, those from Peloponnese after a longer interval, and unless you attend to the matter, the former will be here before you, while the latter will elude you, as they have done before. Such were the contents of Nicias's letter. When the Athenians had heard it, they refused to accept his resignation, but chose him two colleagues, naming Menander and Euthydemus, two of the officers at the seat of war, to fill their places until their arrival, that Nicias might not be left alone with his sickness to bear the whole weight of affairs. They also voted to send out another army and navy, drawn partly from the Athenians on the muster roll, partly from the allies. The colleagues chosen for Nicias were Demosthenes, son of Alcisthenes, and Eurymedon, son of Thucles. Eurymedon was sent off at once about the time of winter solstice, with 10 ships, 120 talents of silver, and instructions to tell the army that reinforcements would arrive, and that care would be taken of them. But Demosthenes stayed behind to organize the expedition, meaning to start as soon as it was spring, and sent for troops to the allies, and meanwhile got together money, ships, and heavy infantry at home. The Athenians also sent 20 vessels from Peloponnese to prevent any one crossing over to Sicily from Corinth or Peloponnese. For the Corinthians, filled with confidence by the favorable alteration in Sicilian affairs which had been reported by the envoys upon their arrival, and convinced of the fleet which they had before sent out had not been without its use, were now preparing to dispatch a force of heavy infantry in merchant vessels to Sicily, while the Lacedaemonians did the like for the rest of the Peloponnese. The Corinthians also manned the fleet of 25 vessels, intending to try the result of a battle with the squadron on guard at Naupactus, and meanwhile to make it less easy for the Athenians there to hinder the departure of their merchantmen by obliging them to keep an eye upon the galleys thus arrayed against them. In the meantime, the Lacedaemonians prepared for their invasion of Attica in accordance with their own previous resolve, and at the instigation of the Syracusans and Corinthians, who wished for an invasion to arrest the reinforcements which they had heard that Athens was about to send to Sicily. Alcibiades also urgently advised the fortification of Decelea and a vigorous prosecution of the war, but the Lacedaemonians derived most encouragement from the belief that Athens, with two wars on her hands, against themselves and against the Siceliots, would be more easy to subdue, and from the conviction that she had been the first to infringe the truce in their former war. They considered the offense had been more on their own side, both on account of their entrance of the Thebans. In the former war, they considered the offense had been more on their own side, both on account of the entrance of the Thebans into Plataea in time of peace, and also of their own refusal to listen to the Athenian offer of arbitration, in spite of the clause in the former treaty that where arbitration should be offered, there should be no appeal to arms. For this reason they thought that they deserved their misfortunes, and took to heart seriously the disaster at Pylos, and whatever else had befallen them. But when, besides the ravages from Pylos, which went on without an intermission, the 30 Athenian ships came out from Argos and wasted part of Epidaurus, Prisai, and other places, when upon every dispute that arose as to the interpretation of any doubtful point in the treaty, their own offers of arbitration were always rejected by the Athenians, the Lacedaemonians at length decided that Athens had now committed the very same offense as they had before done, and had become the guilty party, and they began to be full of ardor for the war. They spent this winter in sending round to their allies for iron, and in getting ready the other implements for building their fort, and meanwhile began raising at home, and also by forced requisition in the rest of Peloponnese, a force to be sent out in the merchantmen to their allies in Sicily. Winter thus ended, and with it the 18th year of this war, of which Thucydides is the historian. In the first days of spring following, at an earlier period than usual, the Lacedaemonians and their allies invaded Attica under the command of Agis, the son of Archidamus, king of the Lacedaemonians. They began by devastating the parts bordering upon the plain, and next proceeded to fortify Decelea, dividing the work among the different cities. Decelea is about 13 or 14 miles from the city of Athens, and the same distance, or not much farther, from Boeotia, and the fort was meant to annoy the plain and the richest parts of the country, being in sight of Athens. While the Peloponnesians and their allies at Attica were engaged in the work of fortification, their countrymen at home sent off at about the same time the heavy infantry and the merchant vessels to Sicily, the Lacedaemonians furnishing a picked force of helots and neodemotes, or freedmen. 600 heavy infantry in all, under the command of Ecphrytus, a Spartan, and the Boeotians, 300 heavy cavalry, commanded by 2 Thebans, Zenon and Nicon, and by Hecazander, a Thespian. These were among the first to put out into the open sea, starting from Taenarus in Laconia. Not long after the departure, the Corinthians sent off a force of 500 heavy infantry, consisting partly of men from Corinth itself, and partly of Arcadian mercenaries, placed under the command of Alex Archis, a Corinthian. The Sicyonians also sent off 200 heavy infantry at the same time as the Corinthians, under the command of Sargius, a Sicyonian. Meantime, the 25 vessels manned by Corinth during the winter lay confronting the 20 Athenian ships at Naupactus, until the heavy infantry at the merchantmen were fairly on their way from Peloponnese, thus fulfilling the object for which they had been manned originally, which was to divert the attention of the Athenians from the merchantmen to the galleys. During this time, the Athenians were not idle. Simultaneously with the fortification of Decelea, at the very beginning of spring, they sent 30 ships round Peloponnese under Charicles, son of Apollodorus, with instruction to call at Argos and land a force of their heavy infantry for the fleet, agreeably to the alliance. At the same time, they dispatched Demosthenes to Sicily, as they had intended, with 60 Athenian and 5 Chian vessels, 1,200 Athenian heavy infantry from the muster roll, and as many of the islanders as could be raised in the different corners, drawing upon the other subject allies for whatever they could supply that would be of use for the war. Demosthenes was instructed first to sail around with Charicles, and to operate with him upon the coast of Laconia, and accordingly sailed to Aegina, and there waited for the remainder of his armament, and for Charicles to fetch the Argive troops. In Sicily, about the same time in this spring, Gylippus came to Syracuse with as many troops as he could bring from the cities which he had persuaded to join. Calling the Syracusians together, he told them that they must man as many ships as possible and try their hand at sea fight, by which he hoped to achieve an advantage in the war not unworthy of the risk. With him Hermocrates actively joined in trying to encourage his countrymen to attack the Athenians at sea, saying that the latter had not inherited their naval prowess, nor would they retain it forever. They had been landsmen even to greater degree than the Syracusans, and had only become a maritime power when obliged by the Mede. Besides, to daring spirits like the Athenians, a daring adversary would seem the most formidable, and the Athenian plan of paralyzing by the boldness of their attack a neighbor, often not their inferior in strength, could now be used against them with as good effect by the Syracusans. He was convinced also that the unlooked-for spectacle of Syracusans daring to face the Athenian navy would cause a terror to the enemy, the advantages of which would far outweigh any loss that the Athenian science might inflict upon their inexperience. He accordingly urged them to throw aside their fears and to try their fortune at sea, and the Syracusans, under the influence of Gylippus at Hermocrates, and perhaps some others, made up their minds for the sea fight and began to man their vessels. When the fleet was ready, Gylippus led out the whole army by night, his plan being to assault in person the forts on Plemmyrium by land, while 35 Syracusan galleys sailed according to appointment against the enemy from the great harbor, and the 45 remaining came round from the lesser harbor where they had their arsenal. In order to effect a junction with those inside and simultaneously to attack Plemmyrium, and thus to distract the Athenians by assaulting them on two sides at once, the Athenians quickly manned 60 ships, and with 25 of these engaged the 35 of the Syracusans in a great harbor, sending the rest to meet those sailing round from the arsenal, and an action now ensued directly in front of the mouth of the great harbor, maintained with equal tenacity on both sides, the one wishing to force the passage, the other to prevent it. In the meantime, while the Athenians in Plemmyrium were down at the sea attending to the engagement, Gylippus made a sudden attack on the forts in the early morning and took the largest first, and afterwards the two smaller, whose garrisons did not wait for him, seeing the largest so easily taken. At the fall of the first fort, the men from it who succeeded in taking refuge in their boats and merchantmen found great difficulty in reaching the camp, as the Syracusans were having the best of it in the engagement in the great harbor, and sent a fast-sailing galley to pursue them. But when two others fell, the Syracusans were now being defeated, and the fugitives from these sailed along shore with more ease. The Syracusan ships, fighting off the mouth of the harbor, forced their way through the Athenian vessels, and sailing in without any order, fell foul of one another, and transferred the victory to the Athenians, who not only routed the squadron in question, but also that by which they were at first being defeated in the harbor, sinking 11 of the Syracusan vessels and killing most of the men, except the crews of 3 ships whom they made prisoners. Their own loss was confined to 3 vessels, and after hauling ashore the Syracusan wrecks and setting up a trophy upon the islet in front of Plemmyrium, they retired to their own camp. Unsuccessful at sea, the Syracusans had nevertheless the forts in Plemmyrium, for which they set up 3 trophies. One of the 2 last taken, they razed, but put in order and garrisoned the 2 others. In the capture of the forts, a great many men were killed and made prisoners, and a great quantity of property was taken in all. As the Athenians had used them as a magazine, there was a large stock of goods and corn of the merchants inside, and also a large stock belonging to the captains, the masts and the other furniture of 40 galleys being taken, besides 3 galleys which had been drawn up on shore. Indeed, the first and chiefest cause of the ruin of the Athenian army was the capture of Plemmyrium, even the entrance of the harbor being now no longer safe for carrying in provisions, as the Syracusan vessels were stationed there to prevent it, and nothing could be brought in without fighting. Besides the general impression of dismay and discouragement produced upon the army. After this, the Syracusans sent out 12 ships under the command of Agatharchus the Syracusan. One of these went to Peloponnese with ambassador to describe the hopeful state of their affairs, and to incite the Peloponnesians to prosecute the war there even more actively than they were doing now, while the 11 others sailed to Italy, hearing that vessels laden with stores were on their way to Athenians. After falling in with and destroying most of the vessels in question, and burning in the Colonian territory a quantity of timber for shipbuilding which had been got ready for the Athenians, the Syracusan squad went to Locri, and one of the merchantmen from Peloponnese, coming in while they were at anchor there, carrying Thespian heavy inventory, took these on board and sailed alongshore towards home. The Athenians were on the lookout for them with 20 ships at Megara, but were only able to take one vessel with its crew, the rest getting clear off to Syracuse. There was also some skirmishing in the harbor about the piles which the Syracusans had driven in the sea in front of the old docks to allow their ships to lie at anchor inside without being hurt by Athenians sailing up and running them down. The Athenians brought up to them a ship of 10,000 talents burden, furnished with wooden turrets and screens, and fastened ropes round the piles from their boats, wrenched them up and broke them, or dived down and sawed them in two. Meanwhile, the Syracusans plied them with missiles from the docks, to which they replied from their large vessel, until at last most of the piles were moved by the Athenians. But the most awkward part of the stockade was the part out of sight. Some of the piles which had been driven in did not appear above water, so that it was dangerous to sail up for fear of running the ships upon them just as upon a reef, though not seeing them. However, divers went down and sawed off even these for reward, although the Syracusans drove in others. Indeed, there was no end to the contrivances to which they resorted against each other, as might be expected between two hostile armies confronting each other at such a short distance, and skirmishes and all kinds of other attempts were of constant occurrence. Meanwhile, the Syracusans sent embassies to the cities composed of Corinthians, Ambraciots, and Lacedaemonians, to tell of the capture of Plemmyrium, and that their defeat in the sea fight was due less to the strength of the enemy than to their own disorder, and generally to let them know that they were full of hope, and to desire them to come to their help with ships and troops, as the Athenians were expected with a fresh army, and if the one already there could be destroyed before the other arrived, the war would be at an end. While the contending parties in Sicily were thus engaged, Demosthenes, having now gotten together the armament with which he was to go to the island, put out from Aegina, and making sail from Peloponnese, joined Charicles and the 30 ships of the Athenians. Taking on board the heavy infantry from Argos, they sailed to Laconia, and, after first plundering part of Epidaurus Limera, landed on the coast of Laconia, opposite Cythera, where the temple of Apollo stands, and, laying part of the country, fortified a sort of isthmus, to which the helots of Lacedaemonians might desert, and from whence plundering incursions might be made as from Pylos. Demosthenes helped to occupy this place, and then immediately sailed on to Corcyra to take up some of the allies in that island, and so to proceed without delay to Sicily, while Charicles waited until he had completed the fortification of the place, and leaving a garrison there, returned home subsequently with his 30 ships and the Argives also. This same summer arrived at Athens 1,300 targeteers, Thracian swordsmen of the tribe of the Dii, who were to have sailed to Sicily with Demosthenes. Since they had come too late, the Athenians determined to send them back to Thrace, whence they had come, to keep them for the Decelean War, appearing too expensive, as the pay of each man was a drachma a day. Indeed, since Decelea had been first fortified by the whole Peloponnesian army during the summer, and then occupied for the annoyance of the country by the garrisons from the cities relieving each other at stated intervals, it had been doing great mischief to the Athenians. In fact, this occupation, by the destruction of property and loss of men which resulted from it, was one of the principal causes of their ruin. Previously, the invasions were short, and did not prevent their enjoying their land during the rest of the time. The enemy was now permanently fixed in Attica. At one time it was an attack in force, at another it was a regular garrison overrunning the country and making forays into it for its subsistence. And the Lacedaemonian king, Agis, was in the field and diligently prosecuting the war. Great mischief was therefore done to the Athenians. They were deprived of their whole country. More than 20,000 slaves had deserted, a great part of them artisans, and all of their sheep and beasts of burden were lost. And as the cavalry rode out daily upon excursions to Decelea and to guard the country, their horses were either lamed by being constantly worked upon rocky ground or wounded by the enemy. Besides the transport of provisions from Euboea, which had before been carried on so much more quickly overhand by Decelea from Oropos, was now effected at great cost by sea around Sunium. Everything the city required had to be imported from abroad, and instead of a city it became a fortress. Summer and winter the Athenians were worn out by having to keep guard on the fortifications during the day, by turns, by nights altogether. The cavalry excepted at the different military posts or upon the wall. But what most oppressed them was that they had two wars at once, and they had thus reached a pitch of frenzy which no one would have believed possible if he had heard of it before it had come to pass. For could any one have imagined that even when besieged by the Peloponnesians entrenched in Attica, they would still, instead of withdrawing from Sicily, stay on there besieging in like manner Syracuse, a town taken as a town, in no way inferior to Athens, or would so thoroughly upset the Hellenic estimate of their strength and audacity, as to give the spectacle of a people which at the beginning of the war some thought might hold out 1 year, some two, none more than three, if the Peloponnesians invaded their country. Now 17 years after the first invasion, after having already suffered from all the evils of war, going to Sicily and undertaking a new war nothing inferior to that which they already had with the Peloponnesians. These causes, the great losses from Decelea, and the other heavy charges that fell upon them, produced a financial embarrassment. And it was at this time that they imposed upon their subjects, instead of a tribute, the tax of a 20th upon all imports and exports by sea, which they thought would bring them in more money, their expenditure being now not the same as at first, but having grown with the war while their revenues decayed. Accordingly, not wishing to incur expense in their present want of money, they sent back at once the Thracians who came too late for Demosthenes, under the conduct of Diotrephes, who was instructed, as they were to pass through Euripus, to make use of them, if possible, in the voyage along shore to injure the enemy. Diotrephes first landed them at Tanagra, and hastily snatched some booty. He then sailed across the Euripus, in the event from Chalcis in Euboea, and disembarking in Boeotia, led them against Mycalessus. The night he passed unobserved near the temple of Hermes, not quite 2 miles from Mycalessus, and at daybreak assaulted and took the town, which is not a large one. The inhabitants being off their guard and not expecting that anyone would ever come up so far from the sea to molest them, the wall being too weak, and in some places having tumbled down, while in others it had not been built to any height, and the gates also being left open through their feeling of security, the Thracians, bursting into Mycalessus, sacked their houses and temples, and butchered the inhabitants, sparing neither their youth nor age, but killing all they fell in with, one after the other, children and women, and even beasts of burden, and whatever other living creature they saw. The Thracian race, like the bloodiest of the barbarians, being even more so when it had nothing to fear. Everywhere confusion reigned, and death in all its shapes, and in particular they attacked a boys' school, the largest that there was in the place, into which the children had just gone, and massacred them all. In short, the disaster falling upon the whole town was unsurpassed in magnitude, and unapproached by any in suddenness and in horror. Meanwhile the Thebans heard of it, and marched to the rescue, and overtaking the Thracians before they got far, recovered the plunder, and drove them into the Euripus and the sea, where the vessels which brought them were lying. The greatest slaughter took place while they were embarking, as they did not know how to swim, and those in the vessels, on seeing what was going on shore, moored them out of the bowshot. In the rest of the retreat, the Thracians made a very respectable defense against the Theban horse, by which they were first attacked, dashing out and closing their ranks according to the tactics of the country, and lost only a few men in the part of the fair. A good number who were after plunder were actually caught in the town and put to death. Altogether, the Thracians had 250 killed out of 1,300, the Thebans and the rest who came to rescue about 20, troopers and heavy infantry, with Scirophondas, one of the Boeotarchs. The Mycalessians lost a large proportion of their population. While Mycalessus thus experienced a calamity for its extent as lamentable as any that happened in the war, Demosthenes, who we left sailing to Corcyra after the building of the fort in Laconia, found a merchantman laying in Phia in Elis, in which the Corinthian heavy infantry were to cross to Sicily. The ship he destroyed, but the men escaped, and subsequently got another in, which they pursued their voyage. After this, arriving at Zacynthus in Cephallenia, he took a body of heavy infantry on board, and sending for some of the Messenians from Naupactus, crossed over to the opposite shore of Acarnania, to Alzia, and to the Acatorium, which was held by the Athenians. While he was in these parts, he was met by Eurymedon, returning from Sicily, where he had been sent, as they had been mentioned, during the winter, with the money for the army, who told him the news, and also that he had heard while at sea that the Syracusans had taken Plemmyrium. Here also Conon came to them, the commander at Naupactus, with news that the 25 Corinthian ships stationed opposite to him, far from giving over the war, were meditating an engagement, and he therefore begged them to send some ships, as his own 18 were not a match for the enemy's 25. Demosthenes and Eurymedon accordingly sent 10 of their best sailors, with Conon to reinforce the squadrons at Naupactus, and meanwhile prepared for the muster of their forces. Eurymedon, who was now the colleague of Demosthenes, and had turned back in consequence of his appointment, sailing to Corcyra to send them to man 15 ships and to enlist heavy infantry, while Demosthenes raised slingers and darters from the parts about Acarnania. Meanwhile, the envoys already mentioned, who had gone from Syracuse to the cities after the capture of Plemmyrium, had succeeded in their mission, and were about to bring the armies that they had collected, when Nicias got scent of it, and sent to the Centoripae and Alisians and other of the friendly Sicels, who held the passes, not to let the enemy through, but to combine to prevent their passing, there being no other way by which they could even attempt it, as the Agrigentines would not give them a passage through their country. Agreeably to this request, the Sicels laid a triple ambuscade for the Siceliots upon their march, and attacking them suddenly, well off their guard, killed about 800 of them, all of the envoys, the Corinthians only excepted, by whom 1,500 who escaped were conducted to Syracuse. About the same time, the Camarinians also came to the assistance of Syracuse with 500 heavy infantry, 300 darters, and as many archers, while the Geloans sent crews for 5 ships, 400 darters and 200 horse. Indeed, almost the whole of Sicily, except the Agrigentines, who were neutral, now ceased merely to watch events as it had hitherto done, and actively joined Syracuse against the Athenians. While the Syracusans, after the Sicel disaster, put off any immediate attack upon the Athenians, Demosthenes and Eurymedon, whose forces from Corcyra had and the continent were now ready, crossed the Ionian Gulf with all of their armament to the Iphigenian promontory, and starting from thence, touched at the Choerades Isles, lying off Iphigenia, where they took on board 150 Iphigenian darters of the Messapian tribe, and after renewing an old friendship with Artus the chief, who had furnished them with the darters, arrived at Metapontium in Italy. Here they persuaded their allies the Metapontines to send with them 300 darters and 2 galleys, and with this reinforcement coasted on to Thurii, where they found the party hostile to Athens recently expelled by a revolution, and accordingly remained there to muster and review the whole army, to see if any had been left behind, and to prevail upon the Thurians resolutely to join them in their expedition, and in the circumstances in which they found themselves, to conclude a defensive and offensive alliance with the Athenians. About the same time, the Peloponnesians, in 25 ships stationed opposite to the squadron of Naupactus to protect the passage of the transport to Sicily, had got ready for engaging and manning some additional vessels, so as to be numerically little inferior to the Athenians anchored off Eurynius in Achaia in the Rhipic country, the place off which they lay being in the form of a crescent, the land forces furnished by the Corinthians and their allies on the spot, came up and ranged themselves upon the projecting headlands on either side, while the fleet, under the command of Polyanthes, a Corinthian, held the intervening space and blocked up the entrance. The Athenians under Diphilus now sailed out against them, with 33 ships from Naupactus and the Corinthians, at first not moving, at length, though, they saw their opportunity, raised the signal, and advanced and engaged the Athenians. After an obstinate struggle, the Corinthians lost 3 ships, and without sinking any altogether, disabled 7 of the enemy, which were struck prow to prow, and had their 4 ships strove in by the Corinthian vessels, whose cheeks had been strengthened for this very purpose. After an action of this even character, in which either party could claim the victory, although the Athenians became masters of the wrecks through the wind, driving them out to sea, the Corinthians not putting out again to meet them, the two combatants parted. No pursuit took place, and no prisoners were made on either side, the Corinthians and Peloponnesians, who were fighting near the shore, escaping with ease, and none of the Athenian vessels having been sunk. The Athenians now sailed back to Naupactus, and the Corinthians immediately set up a trophy as victors, because they had disabled a greater number of the enemy's ships. Moreover, they held that they had not been worsted, for the very same reason that their opponent held that he had not been victorious. The Corinthians considered that they were conquerors, if not decidedly conquered, and the Athenians thinking themselves vanquished, because not decidedly victorious. However, when the Peloponnesians sailed off and their land forces had dispersed, the Athenians also set up a trophy as victors in Achaia, about 2 miles and a quarter from Eurynius, the Corinthian station. This was the termination of the action in Naupactus. To return to Demosthenes and Eurymedon, the Thurians, having now gotten ready to join in the expedition with 700 heavy infantry and 300 darters, the two generals ordered the ships to sail along the coast of the Crotonian territory, and meanwhile held a review of all the land forces upon the Sybaris, and then led them through the Thurian country. Arrived at the river Hylias, they here received a message from the Crotonians saying that they would not allow the army to pass through their country, upon which the Athenians descended toward the shore and bivouacked near the sea and the mouth of the Hylias, where the fleet also met them, and the next day embarked and sailed along the coast, touching at all cities except Locri, until they came to Petra in the Rhegian territory. Meanwhile, the Syracusans, hearing of their approach, resolved to make a second attempt with their fleet and their other forces on the shore, which they had been collecting for this very purpose in order to do something before their arrival. In addition to other improvements suggested by the former sea fight which they now adopted in their equipment of their navy, they cut down their prows to a smaller compass to make them more solid and make their cheeks stouter, and from these let stays into the vessel's sides for a length of 6 cubits within and without, in the same way as the Corinthians had altered their prows before engaging the squadron in Naupactus. The Syracusans thought that they would thus have an advantage over the Athenian vessels, which were not constructed with equal strength, but were slight in the bows, from their being more used to sail round and charge the enemy's side than to meet him prow to prow, and that the battle being in great harbour, with a great many ships in not much room, was also a fact in their favour. Charging prow to prow, they would stave in the enemy's bows by striking with solid and stout beaks against hollow and weak ones, and secondly, the Athenians, for want of room, would be unable to use their favorite maneuver of breaking the line or of sailing around, as the Syracusans would do their best not to let them do the one, and want of room would prevent their doing the other. This charging prow to prow, which had hitherto been thought want of skill in a helmsman, would be the Syracusans' chief maneuver, as being that which they should find most useful, since the Athenians, if repulsed, would not be able to back water in any direction except towards the shore, and that only for a little way, and in the little space in front of their own camp. The rest of the harbor would be commanded by the Syracusans, and the Athenians, if hard-pressed, by crowding together in a small space, and all to the same point, would run foul of one another, and fall into the disorder, which was, in fact, the thing that did the Athenians most harm in all the sea fights, they not having, like the Syracusans, the whole harbor to retreat over. As to their sailing round in the open sea, this would be impossible, with the Syracusans in possession of the way out and in, especially as Plemmyrium would be hostile to them and the mouth of the harbour was not large. With these contrivances to suit their skill and ability, and now more confident in the previous sea fight, the Syracusans attacked by land and sea at once. The town force Gylippus led out a little the first and brought them up to the wall of the Athenians, where it looked toward the city, while the force from the Olympium, that is to say the heavy infantry that were there with the horse and the light troops of the Syracusans, advanced against the wall from the opposite side, the ships of the Syracusans and the allies sailing out immediately afterwards. The Athenians at first fancied that they were to be attacked by land only, and it was not without alarm that they saw the fleet suddenly approaching as well, and while some were forming upon the walls and in front of them against the advancing enemy, and some marching out in haste against the numbers of horse and darters coming from the Olympium, and from outside, others manned the ships or rushed down to the beach to oppose the enemy, and when the ships were manned, put out with 75 sail against about 80 of the Syracusans. After spending a great part of the day in advancing and retreating and skirmishing with each other, without either being able to gain any advantage worth speaking of, except that the Syracusans sank one or two of the Athenian vessels, they parted, the land force at the same time retiring from the lines. The next day the Syracusans remained quiet and gave no sign of what they were going to do, but Nicias, seeing that the battle had been a drawn one and expecting that they would attack again, compelled the captains to refit any of the ships that had suffered, and moored merchant vessels before the stockade which had driven into the sea in front of their ships, to serve instead of enclosed harbour at about 200 feet from each other, in order that any ship that was hard-pressed might be able to retreat in safety and sail out again at leisure. These preparations occupied the Athenians all day until nightfall. The next day the Syracusans began operations at an earlier hour, but with the same plan of attack by land and sea. The great part of the day the rivals spent, as before, confronting and skirmishing with each other, until at last Ariston, son of Pyrrhicus, a Corinthian, the ablest helmsman of the Syracusan service, persuaded their naval commanders to send to the officials in the city and tell them to move the sail market as quickly as they could down to the sea, and oblige everyone to bring whatever eatables that he had and sell them there, thus enabling the commanders to land the crew and dine at once close to the ships, and shortly afterwards the selfsame day to attack the Athenians again when they were not expecting it. In compliance with this advice, a messenger was sent, and the market got ready, upon which the Syracusans suddenly backed water and withdrew to the town, and at once landed and took their dinner upon the spot, while the Athenians, supposing they had returned to the town because they felt they were beaten, disembarked at their leisure and set about getting their dinners and about their other occupations, under the idea that they had done with fighting for that day. Suddenly the Syracusans had manned their ships and again sailed against them, and the Athenians, in great confusion, and most of them fasting, got on board and with great difficulty put out to meet them. For some time both parties remained on the defensive without engaging, until the Athenians at last resolved not to let themselves be worn out by waiting where they were, but to attack without delay, and giving a cheer went into action. The Syracusans received them, and charging prow to prow as they had intended, stove in a great part of the Athenians' foreships by the strength of their beaks. The darters on the decks also did great damage to the Athenians, but still greater damage was done by the Syracusans, who went about in small boats, ran in upon the oars of the Athenian galleys, and sailed against their sides, and discharged from thence their darts upon the sailors. At last, fighting in this action, the Syracusans gained the victory, and the Athenians turned and fled between the merchantmen to their own station. The Syracusans' ships pursued them as far as the merchantmen, where they were stopped by the beams armed with dolphins suspended from those vessels over the passage. Two of the Syracusan vessels went too near in the excitement of victory and were destroyed, one of them being taken with the crew. After sinking 70 of the Athenian vessels and disabling many, and taking most of the men prisoner and killing others, the Syracusans retired and set up trophies for both the engagements, being now confident in having a decided superiority by sea, and by no means despairing of equal success by land. End of Book 7, Chapter 21.